I'm John. I'm Paul. I'm George.
And I play the drums.
From pod617.com, the Boston Podcast Network, it's Get Back to the Beatles with Chachi Lapret. And Chachi's co-host, Beatles instructor at Suffolk University, David Gallant.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Get Back to the Beatles. My name is Chachi Lapret, and you're listening to Get Back to the Beatles on the Boston Podcast Network. We originate out of Boston, and we have a big show for you today. We're very excited. Joining me is our co-host, the great David Gallant, the Beatles professor at Suffolk University. Hello, David. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Chachi, as well. Spring has sprung. A little bit cool today here in Boston, but we're getting there.
But we have a highly notable author with us today. I've known about Stephen Gaines for many years as I hold my original The Love You Make book.
Wow.
And back in the day, I worked at WBCN in Boston for many years. And back in the day, Stephen and Peter Brown came to the radio station where they autographed my book, 1983.
Holy cow, that's Peter.
And
he lived for me on the bottom, that's on it. He takes up the whole page. That's wonderful that you have that. That's
it's
great.
One of my prized possessions because I really enjoyed the book. Now you have a follow-up to the book. It's called All You Need Is Love, The Beatles in Their Own Words on St. Martin's Press. A fantastic edition, long-awaited follow-up to The Love You Make. And so welcome to Get Back to the Beatles, Stephen. We're so honored to have you here. And so you had a long journey with this book, starting with when you were working with Peter. It was shelved for a while. The tapes sat in a vault for years. And you and Peter discussed, well, how can we work with this? And you found a way. So tell us how that all went down.
Well, when The Love You Make came out, there was a lot of talk about doing a movie and then it fell through and that didn't happen. And collaboration is very difficult. When The Love You Make first came out, it was written in third person. My idea was that Peter would help me write a book about the Beatles and that he would not be a first person in it. And I wrote half of the book and handed that in. And the publishers at the time, McGraw-Hill, loved it. But they said, it's got to be first person. And I said, I'm not going to write somebody else's autobiography. And they said, no. They said, we got to put him in. So what happened? I can't tell you what this was like. I'll show you. So I changed the book in a lot of places. I think for the first 80 pages of The Love You Make, there is no first person. And then I had to dot the book with Peter Brown's first person. So when we came out of that and the book was a big hit, neither of us, I think, wanted to think about the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles is Peter's life. For me, I had other things to do. I had somebody to my, I love the Beatles, but I didn't think it was going to envelop me the way it did. And so I had all the tapes that I made. The way The Love You Make was written and the way these tapes in the new book, All You Need Is Love, was done was I had a little cassette recorder where we're looking in 1980 now, and the technology wasn't that terrific. It wasn't like a stereo cassette recorder or anything like that. It was some junky thing from Radio Shack, and I would put in a 90-minute tape, and I would put it on the table or wherever it was in front and ask if I record. And then I transcribed the tapes by hand, I think. I'm pretty sure I did, because there also wasn't some method where you could make it into an MP3 file and then get it transcribed. And then I put the tapes in, first in my basement, and then I put them in a bank vault in East Hampton. And they were there for a long time. Peter Brown and I had discussions through the years on and off about what to do with the tapes. He didn't really want to do anything. Now he says it's me that didn't want to do anything, but he really didn't want to do anything because he felt it was too revealing. The book was very, very polarizing, and I think he was embarrassed by some of the controversy that went on. Peter is very proper. He's a CBE, a citizen of the British Empire, and all that stuff. And I think that the controversy about the tapes in the beginning sort of embarrassed him and made him uncomfortable. So at first, I'm a journalist, so I mean, you can't be easily embarrassed if you're a journalist. So in any event, that they were in a bank vault and we discussed them on and off. And there were years went by when we didn't even speak to each other. And then I remember New Year's Eve of 1979, 17 into 1918, I went over to a house that he was staying in out here in East Hampton where I lived. And I brought a little thing of caviar and a bottle of champagne. And I toasted it. I said, let's do something with these tapes. And he said, I will never sell the tapes. That was the idea, was selling them. And then we found out from many lawyers that you can't play the voice of a living person for money without their permission. And at the time, we never thought of getting anybody's permission because we had no thought of going any further with it than that book. So that was a big stumbling block. Then more years went by, and I decided that we could transcribe the tapes and that I could make those tapes into an MP3 file and that I could send them off to a place that does transcriptions. And the next morning, I'd have an entire transcription of what the tapes, what was on the tapes. So that changed everything for us. We went to market and we were turned down by 20 publishers. But no, and the last publisher was St. Martin's. And they said that they would take a chance on it for not much big bucks. And so that's how this started. That's how All You Need Is Love started. We had the tapes transcribed. We sold the book, and I spent nearly a year editing them down because I think that I don't know exactly how many words the tapes came to, but it could easily be 200,000 words, easily 200,000 words. And so, because each tape was 90 minutes and there were about 70 tapes. So the publisher said it could only be 100,000 words. I kept on saying, these tapes are historic. And publishers would go, what are you talking about? It's the Beatles. I said, no, the Beatles are bigger than the Beatles. And they would say to me, Elvis Presley, Monroe. I said, no. These guys, hundreds of years from now, they're going to be studying this whole thing, the music, the evolution, the way they changed music, the way they opened a new arena for popular music when they did in 67, at least for me. So they said, no, we don't need all that stuff about that extra stuff. So I edited it down to 100,000 words. I made a lot of mistakes too, which the fans are howling about. I made some stupid mistakes and some mistakes I wasn't even aware of. I mean, I wasn't aware of the stupid mistakes either, but you would think I would know that Ringo was not engaged to his mother and stuff like that. But you become snowblind. I mean, you really do. All you see is names on papers and going back and forth and stuff like that. So should I shut up? Am I talking?
No, I love hearing you. No, it's great.
So that's what happened. And we even left out interviews that were repetitive of the information that it was already given. And in fact, I didn't know what to do with that because you got to remember, it was 1980. And it was March or so of 1980, February of 1980, and I was broke. I was living in Greenwich Village. I didn't have a job. I was miserable. My grandma was sending me money. I was a grown man already in 1980. And Peter was living in a three-bedroom penthouse apartment on a cliff above Laguna Beach. So, and New York was dark and cold. So he called me and he said, I'm ready to write that Beatle book. And come here, you stay in a guest bedroom. And so that's what I did. I got on the next plane and I went to Laguna and he told me everything that he could tell me and remember. And I wrote the original proposal for The Love You Make in Laguna. And we got a book contract and we left for England, I think very early September of 1980. Now, who knew what was going to, the horrible tragedy that was going to happen on December 8th. There was just no, how would you know? And so we interviewed all these people and the interviews, and it, of course it shows in these transcripts, there's a very narrow field of interest. I asked a lot about Brian because I wanted to write about Brian Epstein a great deal. And so these tapes reflect that. I wouldn't have done that if I was doing it now. I would have asked different kinds of questions. But that's basically what happened. Like we did all the interviews except for Yoko and John. And we came back to America, I think, for Thanksgiving. And we were supposed to go back to England. But Thanksgiving weekend, and right after that was December 8th, and John was murdered. And And that's it. So Peter moved back to California and I moved from Manhattan to here, where I've been ever since.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's broken up into chapters with conversations with some fascinating people, some that we want to ask you about. But you did mention that the Beatles will be studied for 100 years to come and beyond. And that certainly is right up Beatle Professor David Gallant's alley. He's been teaching the Beatles course to Suffolk University freshmen for about 20 years. Wow. So, David, I'll bring you into the conversation.
Sure. Chachi, you really outdid me, though, because I didn't realize we were going to be showing our objects of affection, meaning our books. And down in my office, I'm in a separate conference room. Of course, I have a much more downbeat, small paperback version of The Love You Make. No endorsements in it. I bought it at a used bookstore on Newbury Street, Chachi Avenue, Victor Hugo Books, a wonderful place. And I bought it when I was in college or maybe grad school. And it's part of the Beatles library. It's part of the Beatles narrative. And it has a very important place with all the other foundational texts, right, with Philip Norman and all the others with folks that we've spoken to and everything who are chronicling that age. And so it's very important. And this now, The Love You Make, All You Need Is Love, is I liken it to what the Beatles did with music in the years after. Finding the lost tapes, finding different versions, finding different angles of a song. We have all these different angles of the stories. And I mean, Bob Dylan has had as much of an output of what he recorded in his studio as has been out there of his outtakes collection, right? And those are no less important. And I think of this book as really being like, it's no longer on the cutting room floor. These were extra tapes. And now we've had the technology to put them together. And I think a lot of it is fascinating. I think it is something where you can dive in the middle and you can take a segment or a fragment, but there are great fragments, not necessarily living next to each other, Stephen, that you can piece together. If you want the sort of, well, not to quote Lucy in the Sky, but a kaleidoscopic view, right? Four or five different angles of Magic Alex. You'll get it from four or five different people. How the opinion of Yoko was then, how it has changed since, you get that, right? I mean, I don't necessarily have known too many impressions of India and the Maharishi through Jenny Boyd or through Patty Boyd, right? And so these are some great little pieces that you have here. If we think of like some of what had been considered minor characters become major characters in what I consider to be these great collected outtakes, Alan Klein, Magic Alex, but people's opinions of them, those who were starry-eyed, those who were clear-eyed. I think that, and I can attach, even though you didn't have the right to put out the recorded voices, having studied the anthology enough, I can attach Neil Aspinall's voice to the interviews here. And he is probably the most clear-eyed of just about anybody, and his passages are fantastic to read. So I think it was fantastic. Chachi, I'll twist an old line from a famous song, right? That I was so happy to know that Stephen Gaines called to say he could make it okay and he could be on our podcast today. How's that, Chachi? Because if Peter Brown had gotten the credit all these years for being a line in a great lyric of a great song, well, I think Stephen deserves his right to that
Thank
place.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, and these are great snippets to put out there, Stephen, because I'm not a musician. I'm not a musicologist. My training is in writing and English and literature. And I think that these are great moments from a journalist's point of view in interviews to really access the history of the time. We use this as a jumping off point to learn about such things as drug laws of the time, laws restricting and against homosexuality of the time, fear of outsiders, whether it was an American photographer in Linda Eastman or a Japanese conceptual artist in Yoko Ono, and what that brings up in terms of sexism, racism, and everything. And these are great documents to study the voices and where those things came from in a cultural context. So all of this is fantastic. When you said, were you encountering the same trouble finding a publisher for this book?
As you did yes. For The Love You Make, there was an auction. For this book, nobody was interested.
I'm amazed and astounded and confounded by that, because I know that over time, tastes can change, but I think human desire doesn't. And I never thought that the human desire to learn more about the Beatles ever goes away or ever lessens or ever wanes. And so maybe that this is less of a sense of what they understand about the reading public and more about their their marketplace ideas, right? And the capitalism of publishing. Maybe that's where they get it wrong.
I agree. I was just, I'll tell you something else about people not understanding how important these tapes were. I guess one thing was, is that we came out with them, that these tapes are historic, and they just couldn't see past that. But here's something that you're really going to be surprised about. I also wrote a book about the Beach Boys, and David Leap is a Beach Boy professor at UCLA, a great guy. And he had the librarian at the School of Music there at UCLA call me and say, we would like your Beach Boy tapes. So I thought, what an honor to have them at UCLA. That would be great. I said, I got a surprise for you. How would you like all of my Beatle tapes? And they said, no, we don't want Beatle tapes. But the Beach Boys are UCLA, it's California. I said, but you don't understand. You have a music school. And these are, and they said, no. And so I said, well, if you won't take my Beatle tapes, then I don't want you to have the Beach Boy tapes. I mean, I would go back to them now and say, please take the Beach Boy tapes, because it's very hard to place stuff like this. Remember, I did the Beach Boys, the Beatles, Alice Cooper, I forget who else, but a lot of terrific tapes. And yet it's very, very hard to find a place. Doesn't take a broom on a shelf. They're MP3 files. They live in a cloud. So
do they imagine that the interest in historical research or even in teaching courses that the Beatles would be so not universal and so localized? I mean, do the tapes have to be offered to Liverpool Hope University, right, where they have the master's degree in the Beatles? I understand, Chachi, it sounds like the old days of Capitol Records. No, we're going to put our weight behind the Beach Boys. We don't understand that English stuff, right?
Right,
and
right.
And I think Brian Wilson might say, no, take the Beatles stuff too.
Yes. Well, I suggested to Peter that we give them to Liverpool University, whatever the school there is called. And even in his name, I mean, it does the Peter Brown tapes, even though I do the interviews. But that, besides the point, I wanted him to have the honor. He's pushing 90 and everything. But, you know, he's reticent. And I just might, the tapes are mine. I just might as well, I mean, legally they're mine. I just might as well donate them on my own at some point.
Well, there is a facility in town here that the professor and I know called the David Bieber Archives. He has 2 million pieces of cultural artifacts. He's a dear friend of ours, David Bieber, B-I-E-B-E-R.
Right.
The David Bieber Archives in Norwood, Massachusetts. But that aside, let's get into this a little bit, because I remember meeting you and Peter in 83 when you signed my book.
Were we obnoxious?
No, not at all. But I remember Peter Brown being such a proper gentleman, an English gentleman.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, in all his photos, he looks the same. He's very proper. He's in a suit. And so I found him to be a really nice guy, very engaging. And you mentioned that he was unsure maybe about the book, but ultimately you hear these stories. Paul McCartney got the book and he burned it, right? Paul and Linda. You said it was polarizing. And even David Putman, these are some of the great people. I didn't even know of this guy. He kind of warned you. He said, you're gonna upset the Beatles. Will you be friends with them? Oh, no, it was Bob Wooler. I would make a mistake. It was
Bob Wooler. Peter.
Yeah, Bob Wooler said he was pushing back on you a bit. You were asking questions about when John punched him. He didn't want to give you that information. And then he said, he warned you, how would the Beatles view the finished book? And will you still be friends with the Beatles after its release? So how did you and Peter react to the negative reaction? It tells me that maybe the book is truthful and they don't want the information out there. But what's your take?
You know what the thing was? It was 1980. I know that wasn't exactly ancient times, but people weren't ready for it yet. People weren't ready to hear that about their idols, hear that. The thing is, everybody thought it was this perfect Camelot. The Beatles didn't have groupies. They didn't argue with each other and all of that. The point of the thing that polarized people the most, that infuriated everybody, that we heard it from, was Brian Epstein and Brian Epstein's trip to Spain with John. It was endless. in 1980. Now, if I had just released that now, they'd say, oh, sure, straight guys sometimes experiment or whatever the answer is. Maybe it didn't happen. I don't know. But they did go away to Spain. But people were outraged. The Beatle fans were so outraged that I might suggest something like that. And now I think people would just shrug. So that was one thing. Paul never spoke to Peter Brown again. And
did that hurt Peter? Was he?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In fact, when we started to do this book, Peter kept on saying, we have to be very careful about Paul McCartney. We have to be very careful about Paul. And so, I mean, I was tiptoeing around Paul because, so finally, 6 months went by and I wrote Peter an email. And the email said, Paul McCartney will never speak to you again. We have to do this book as it is. I cannot fashion this book, so perhaps Paul will forgive you. And Paul wouldn't forgive him. And in fact, Peter tells a story about how he was in some fancy schmancy resort, like St. Bart's or something. And Paul was there with his wife now, Nancy Chevelle, however it's pronounced. And he saw her, and because Peter says that he knew Nancy from someplace before, and he saw her and he went over and spoke to her and introduced himself. And she said, oh, hi, I know you. And then Paul came over and he said, why are you talking to my wife?
Wow.
And so Peter just backed away. Paul was really, and I think the thing that Paul was angry about was the sheep dip when he had crabs and he sent Alistair Taylor to the drugstore to get him that. I think that's probably what Paul was most upset about.
That was the straw, because I mean, Chachi and I have spoken to Philip Norman, and after Shout came out, Paul, I'm sure, vowed, I will never speak to Philip Norman again, because he was sort of the king mixer, the one coming out looking, smelling less like a rose than all of them after Norman's. And then he ended up writing a biography of McCartney after all those years. And so, but I guess there might just be one or two things that people will vow, I can never move off of that block, which is very, very odd, rather quirky. And your work and Peter's work was not really all that, you know, earth shattering compared to other things that had been in print or suggested in film or in other interviews. And I think if they felt as though because Peter was involved, it was some type of inner circle betrayal,
that's
maybe?
That's exactly it.
Because a lot of the stuff that supposedly people were mad about, you have in other, there are other prints, other journalists, other books. If from the early days, that great book, Chachi, now I'm going to forget it. Oh, Love Me Do, right? The great book about the early Beatles that was written in that time of pre-Beatlemania, even before they got to the U.S. All of the some of that nasty stuff is there about Hamburg and everything, right? So, yeah. But I guess sense of betrayal.
I think the thing is that there's, what's the Italian word, omerta? Is that on I mean, he was, I met Peter when I was a rock and roll columnist for the Sunday News here in New York City. And Peter had left the Beatles and was living in New York and was president of the Robert Stigwood Organization, and RSO managed the Bee Gees and Eric Clapton. And they produced Sgt. Pepper, the Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway. And they also had this terrible, crappy little show called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band on the Road. They were really cashing in on it. But Peter somehow finagled the rights, and he convinced John Lennon to come and publicize. They invited like 10 journalists only. And John showed up at the theater where the rehearsals were going on. And then you kind of like waited in line, not in a line really, but you knew who was next. And then you were able to talk to John for 5 minutes. And I was so totally freaked out that it was John Lennon. I couldn't do anything but map his face in my mind. It was, and I was a rock and roll columnist. I met a lot of famous rock and rollers, but it's John Lennon. And I just couldn't, even now it makes me. And so I said, the dumbest thing in the world. I said, does it make you feel old to see Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band becoming an off-Broadway show? And he said, I don't need that to make me feel old, mate. Next. And then, so Peter Brown came over to me. I said, that was short. And I said, well, I think I asked him a stupid question. So he said, come with me. And we went up to the lounge of this theater. And I didn't ask him these questions, but he told me the story of his life. I put on the tape recorder, and for an hour, Peter spoke. and told me the unvarnished story of his life. And when that was over, I said, you got to write a book. And he said, the inner crowd, I will never write a book. The inner group, the Liverpools, the guy that came from Liverpools, and Peter was one of them, I will never, ever write a book. And then I got that phone call. He decided to write a book. And we realized at that point, before John's death, that the book would make a lot of money. The book made fabulous amounts of money. It was just amazing what the advances were at the time. But once Peter broke the code of a murder, once Peter spilled the beans, and also he got all the interviews. And the way he did it was he told the Beatles that we were writing a book about the 60s. Did not say it was a Beatle biography. It did not say it was a tell-all. It did not say any of that. He said, we were writing a book about the 60s. And if you read Paul's transcript in this book, he says something about, oh, is this going to be fit into your book about the 60s? Or is this the kind of stuff? I mean, he suspected Paul, but even so, he was so open, Paul. He just told me everything. I mean, there were no gotcha questions or any of that. He finally kind of was getting it off his shoulders.
Well, I got to tell you, you appreciate this as a journalist. Newsflash, The Love You Make and All You Need Is Love are books about the 60s. Absolutely. And in fact, in All You Need Is Love, I think some of the fascinating vignettes are from, as Chachi mentioned, the gallery owners like Robert Fraser, the photographers, the artists, the lawyers. Because from their practitioner point of view, you understand how the Beatles created those centers. And it involved class, and it involved, yes, money, but also people collaborating in a certain way, and then going out from there. That when artists was going to make their way, if they were close enough to that circle, to make their way converging with the Beatles and then going off and then making their name for themselves. Much like, I mean, everyone knew Warhol, but you do the Sticky Fingers album cover. You talk about the tailor where they were all wearing his clothes except for George walking across Abbey Road. Then you've got your name for yourself that way. So they are books about the 60s. So you guys stay true to what you said you were going to do.
Okay, I'll tell Peter. He'll feel no better at all. You know, Paul speaks to me. I must tell you a wonderful story about Peter, because Peter never backs down. And it's a wonderful trait that he has. But when he was with the Beatles, and he had one of his senior positions at the Beatles, a reporter from Rolling Stone came to Apple, to 3 Savile Row, to interview Peter. And Peter was saying, well, we're really worried about the blacklegging of albums. And the reporter from Rolling Stone said to him, don't you mean bootlegging of albums? And Peter said, no, blacklegging. That's what they're calling it now. And I always remember that moment that there was no way that you could convince Peter that something was wrong or that he would back down. But this is, in fact, I mean, the thing that I love about all the outside people is the stories about playing games with Alan Klein and I forget whose house they played the games with, but these little minutiae things were very, very telling about them. And to just the people that you never heard of, it's interesting to read the reviews on Amazon. I'm not saying that that's the intelligentsia on Amazon writing these reviews, but one review said, they don't even have John. They don't even have John's interview. I mean, what was he thinking when he bought the book, this guy? Didn't he understand the circumstances? A lot of people complained about the mistakes, which I am very ashamed. I can't blame anybody else. I made stupid mistakes in my speaking and stupid mistakes. And I apologize. And all of those errors have been corrected in the newer editions all around the world. Every single error that was pointed out to us. A lot of the people that wrote the negative reviews on Amazon don't realize what the purpose of the book was or even what they were reading. They wanted more fan information. I don't know what they thought it was going to be, but it is what it is. And I still think it's a piece of history. And I would love to give the other 100,000 words, a lot of which are, would you like more tea? Or, I mean, we interviewed a couple of secretaries, people who were in charge. There used to be a television division of Brian Epstein's company, of NEMS, the lady who was in charge of that. So We had to get rid of some of those, but you're absolutely right. I haven't. There was a big publishing party that Peter Brown threw for himself in his fabulous apartment over Central Park West, and I took, it's 2 hours by bus at least from where I live into the city, and I walked in and there were so many people and famous people and everybody was all dressed up and it was so crushed you couldn't move around, and then everybody kept on coming over and saying stupid things. I'm writing a book about this. Can I send you this? And it was just, it was overpowering. So after a half an hour, I said, I've got to go. And I left. And I got on the next bus in 2 hours. So I get back here and my phone's ringing off the hook. And they said, what happened to you? Peter Brown stopped the whole party, made a speech, and then said, I'd like you to meet my co-author, Stephen Gaines. Please come up here. And then it was Stephen, where is he? And then somebody said, check in the bathroom. And then this whole thing went on. And then somebody said, no, he left. I saw him go out the door. So we haven't spoken since then. We haven't spoken. I'm sure we'll speak again at some point.
We're going to take a minute right now to tell you about another podcast that you should definitely check out. It's called Past Tens, a top 10 time machine.
That's right, Chachi. Tens, as in T-E-N-S. Your host, David Yaz, and the Chartmeister, Michael Meltwolf, travel back in time to revisit the top 10 hits on the Billboard charts on a given day in the past. Sometimes the songs hold up nicely, other times they make you cringe, and that's when comedy and chaos ensue on Past Tense.
You know, David, I think the best episode was when they went back to 1964 because the list was packed with Beatles songs, and also because those bozos, Milt and Dave, respectively, had the good sense to have us on that episode to school them on all things Beatles.
I agree, Chachi. That was a fantastic episode, probably their best. But also check out the episode where I filled in for Milt. It spared the audience the usual allotment of milk fart jokes. You'll have to listen to it to what other types of bodily function jokes are put in.
I had no idea that you were a guest host. I feel offended and betrayed, but I have to admit, for a couple of knuckleheads, these guys put on a fantastic show. It's Past Tens, a top 10 time machine. Find it anywhere you get your podcasts or visit timemachinepod.com. That's timemachinepod.com.
From pod617.com, the Boston Podcast Network. You're listening to Get Back to the Beatles with Chachi Lapret.
God bless Peter Brown. He's still with us, and we love that. But, you know, there's a lot of people that you have in your book who aren't here anymore. The numbers are dwindling, and I found some of the interviews really interesting. And someone who's around now still is May Pang with her documentary.
Love May Pang. Love her.
Great, right? And I'm wondering if you saw the documentary, your thoughts on that, if you can recall your conversation with May. We've become friends with May over the years. She's a dear friend. We brought her to Boston as the first stop in her tour for her photographs at City Winery Boston. She's a really fantastic woman.
Isn't she? Great. Yes. I love May.
Yes. So if you could talk about May for a bit.
I always wonder if May... if this is still a sanitized version. I mean, part of the goodness of May Pang is that she doesn't want to hurt anybody or stir up any trouble. And so I always wonder if there's more to what May is saying. But and my interview with her in this book isn't really very good. I mean, if I had that interview to do over, well, the thing is, I probably wouldn't have done it any different because May is, she's not, certainly not fragile. She's Steel Magnolia, but I think that I would have asked the whole band, and this is a remarkable thing. She's approved of by John and Yoko to go and kind of watch over him and be his companion, and speaks to Yoko almost every day on the telephone and reports in. She was involved in one of the most amazing relationships as the go-between. And kind of a cruel way when they decided to end it. Bye, see ya. And I said, what did you say? And she, to Yoko, and I think she says to Yoko, you won, or something like that. Not that I think May was ever in the running, but I think she's great. And I think that she's got a bad rap because she did a wonderful thing with John. And if you read, or if you look at the documentary of Harry Nilsson, you see that a lot was going on, more than May Pang is saying. a lot was going on in John's life and everything that was happening in Los Angeles at the time. Can I tell you completely off another crazy story?
Please do.
So, I mean, this is, I've promised myself that I was not going to tell the story because it's so ridiculously unbelievable that I'd be making a fool of myself. But this is what the story was. I wrote Alice Cooper's autobiography. I loved Alice. He was really, really a great guy. And in writing the book, I traveled with him. Sometimes he even slept in the same hotel room. Well, because Alice couldn't be alone. He couldn't drive. He was usually too drunk to drive. He needed somebody to play golf with. They made me take golf lessons, his manager, so I could play golf with him. And even after the book was out, I was like Alice's roadie or companion or something. I had a column in the New York Sunday News, which I was writing, but I would write it from the road and then fax it or something. And I was with Alice an awful lot. And so one night in Los Angeles, the book gets long out and I'm sleeping in, I think, a closet in the maid's room in the house that he was on an air mattress. And he said, I'm bored. Let's go to On the Rocks. And On the Rocks was a nightclub above the Roxy, which was a rock and roll club where a lot of bands came to. And I said, okay, great. Let's go to the Roxy. But it was early. It was like 10:30 or something. And so we went there. The place was totally empty. So Alice had a Rolls Royce. And so I'm driving Alice's Rolls Royce. And Alice is sitting next to me. And we go to On the Rocks. And we walk in. The place is empty. There's like four or five people. One of them is Ringo. So, and Alice says, oh, hi, how are you and everything? And this is my friend, Steven. He doesn't say I'm a journalist, I'm a writer, I'm a columnist or anything like that. He just, this is my friend, Steven. And the Ringo immediately thought I was the roadie, the guy that drove him around everything, which was fine. I didn't do it. And the other thing is I went through only a few times in my life have I done this thing that I did when I met John, which is to freeze. But it was Ringo. And again, this was something, it was so unheard of. So Ringo says, and here it gets even more unbelievable. This place is dead. He said, I'm supposed to shoot pool with Peter Lawford. Ringo says this. He says, do you want to come to Alice? So I was sure. He says to me, you want to go shoot pool? I said, yeah. I mean, I couldn't breathe at that point already. So we go downstairs. They bring Ringo's car to him. The valet brings Ringo's car to him. I'm behind the wheel of Alice's Rolls. I follow Ringo. I remember exactly how we went down Sunset to Doheny, and we made a left turn on a street called Dick Street, which is not a very, very fancy street, but had lovely houses. And we parked there and we rang the doorbell, and it was like Peter Lawford. And there were a bunch of young ladies there that Peter said was on loan from Heth, he said. And I don't know if I embroidered this part in my memory or not, but I think they were topless. But the part that I didn't embroider in my memory was that there was a tray full of cocaine. Alice didn't do any drugs at all, but certainly Peter Lawford and Ringo and I did. Cocaine was the worst thing I could have done, because now I was not only like, it's Peter Lawford, it's, I was just, well, what is happening here? And this is, so I want to get camera and I want to jump in down and say to everybody I'm here, but I was shaking and enormously paranoid. And they gave me the pool cue. I don't know if you can see. They gave me the pool cue, and I was like this trying to. So Ringo said to me, calm down, pal. We're just a couple of guys shooting pool. Really relax. Relax about it. Oh, he touched me so. He touched me so. He was so kind. That was so nice. I didn't really ever calm down that night. But I thought about it, and I thought about it for a long time. And then I got to interview. And I didn't tell the story much because what is he making this up? Who's in next? The King of England, Princess Diana is going to walk in. I mean, this is so stupid. So then we go to interview Ringo. And I think I interviewed Ringo at the Plaza Hotel. Peter Brown and I go to interview Ringo 5-7 years past. And this isn't in the book. I specifically cut it out of the book because when my interview, as I'm talking to Ringo during the interview, he said, I like this. Ask me more questions. That was pretty wild. And sure. I could see he really was kind of getting off on having an intelligent conversation and not a fanzine conversation, everything. And so when the whole thing was over and the tape recorder was still running, I said, you and I once met before. And he says to me, yeah, Peter Lawford's house, I remember. So I was, oh my God, I've got it on tape. It's true. It wasn't a dream. It's really true. But I couldn't leave that in the manuscript.
When Ringo said that to you, calm down. He wasn't being snide or rude. He was very nice. Hey, man, it's okay.
He was a nice man. And so was Alice Cooper, a very, very nice man. John was cutting, abrupt, angry. John Lennon, cutting, abrupt, angry. Very, very difficult. Not just at that time when I said something stupid and he dismissed me. But in general, when you hear about what he did, like sending Magic Alex to spy on Cynthia and all these really terrible things, George really was so looking forward to interviewing George. But, you know, in the Ruddles, in the Beatles fake documentary, they call him Mr. Lecturer or something like that. And it's really true. When I said it, first of all, talk about living in the material world, George had the biggest house of any of them. It wasn't a house. It was a palace. It was like one of those incredible things. And when we first walked in, there were bicycles, many, many bicycles there. And I said, what are the bikes for? And they said, to get to the other side of the house. I swear to you, George's house was so big that they had a bicycle around the house because it would take them 4 minutes to get to the other side. So we went into the kitchen and he said, can I make you some tea? I don't know where Peter went. Peter disappeared a lot during the interviews because there were questions that I could ask that if he was there, it would seem untowards, whatever untowards means. So Peter disappeared a lot. And George said, can I make some tea? So I said, yeah, I'd love some tea. And I said, can I use the bathroom? So he says, yeah, it's like around there. I didn't have to take a bicycle. It was a bathroom near the kitchen. So I walk into this bathroom and the bathroom is just absolutely huge. And so I had my camera with me, and 35 millimeter camera, whatever it was. And so I took pictures of the bathroom. I have those pictures, by the way. Nobody wants to publish pictures of George's bathroom. But in any event, because I knew I couldn't take pictures of George, I'd see David said, maybe they will want to. So in any event, I went back in the kitchen and we sat down. And he put a little tea cozy on the teapot. And we were drinking tea and he was lecturing me about molecules and cells, and we're all knots in a string, and our karma is to untie the knots, and all of this stuff and everything. So now I asked him if he was aware of the choices that he made, how deeply it affected the culture and society, not just listening to Indian music, but first time I heard about meditation, transcendental meditation, or anything like that, was because of George and the Beatles. Patty Harrison, by the way, Patty Harrison Clapton, Patty Boyd Harrison Clapton, takes credit for that. She's very, very definite about the fact that she was the one who first knew the Maharishi, heard the Maharishi, and she was the one that got them to go up to see the Maharishi. But anyway, George and I are sitting in his kitchen, and I said, are you aware of the deep effect that you had on everybody? And he said, oh, well, sort of, and everything. And I said, well, I'll give you an idea. When I was 19 or 20 years old, George, and you grew all that long hair and a mustache, I grew this mustache because of you. And he said to me, well, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. don't say that, George.
You didn't even get to tell him that Chachi has a white suit because of the concert for Bangladesh.
You do really have a white suit?
As soon as I saw it, I went out and bought a white suit.
Isn't it interesting also, by the way, that the clothing that they're wearing as they cross Abbey Road was by Peter Brown's boyfriend, Tommy Nutter? Tommy Nutter, the designer, was at the time Peter Brown's boyfriend. That's why Tommy Nutter gets called to the studio to listen to the whatever cut it was. I forget what it is. But Tommy Nutter was a pretty famous hip designer at the time. He's passed away now. But that's how they got to wear Tommy Nutter clothing.
Except so the Abbey Road clothes.
Except for George, yeah.
Yes, the clothes that they're wearing on the cover of Abbey Road was from Tommy Nutter, which Peter arranged. And they first met Tommy when he came to the studio that night to hear, I forgot what song it is now.
Well, if it's what I read in the book, I think, did he hear The End?
No, it wasn't the end, but it doesn't matter. Love Is All You Need. I don't really remember what song it was, but that's where he met them. And because I always thought about the clothing on that cover. And it was only when I re-edited or went through the tapes again that I realized that they were Tommy Nutter clothing. But naturally, George wasn't interested in dressing like the rest of them, which is the story of the Beatles.
Yeah.
No. Do we have time? I know I'm going on like crazy, but
if you have time, I'm fine.
Mr. David, do you have something to ask me or?
No, I'm all ears listening in a fascinated way to all of this. I mean,
thank you.
That wasn't really a diversion. I think the story of playing pool. I mean, it went back to the Beatles, didn't it? You started the evening with Alice Cooper. You made it alive through topless playmates and cocaine. And seeing Ringo. So that's quite striking. But I think that some of the shorter vignettes are also some of the most poignant. You mentioned that, well, people are complaining, where's John? Well, obviously he's all over this text. I mean, they're not reading his words as he voiced them to someone, but he's all over the text. Just the one little bit of John and Paul kind of debuting Hey Jude for Peter Brown is just, it's a brief piece. It's the dead center of the book for me. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful tale of a song that for all of their problems, John thought, this is the best thing you've done. This is, of course, he would say it was about him, but even with all of its universal content and message, I thought that was just a fascinating bit. And it's a page and a half, but it's just so dead center perfect. So you do get John all over it, right? Especially as the musician and the thinker, and really knowing that their songs were going to be something for the whole world. That is really probably one of my favorite pieces. And the other is to get that different view, speaking of George, of the whole fiasco of going out to Haight-Ashbury during the Summer of Love. I love the reminiscence about that from Neil and from Patty as well. I think that's also one of my favorites that I'll now try and do a little bit more with that era in class, how that was defined, how it was picked up. No offense by the press and journalists to trump it up to something that at the base of it was awful. Some of it was pretty awful, actually. And even with all the high ideals, you're going to have a certain element underneath. And it wasn't Nirvana and it wasn't Paradise. And George found himself, oh, crap, I'm basically having to run from people like it's a Hard Day's Night again. So I found that to be really fascinating, really, those two bits. But
was it Patty who said that they hated the hippies because the hippies were dirty?
I guess, yes. Yeah. And that it had all, of course, taken on a different meaning beyond spirituality or living a simple life or anything political, that it became something to go out and do and probably deepened their perspective about maybe the hard drugs were not the way to enlightenment. It could have been more of an elevator straight to hell in a lot of ways.
I think what was going on in London was there was an anti-war movement, of course, of young people in London, but what was going on there was swinging London.
Right.
A whole other thing. And it was about class had broken down and now you could be from the poor class's background. And it was a whole different that was happening there. And then in America, when they got to America and they thought they were going to see these spiritual people, what they found in San Francisco was, I mean, one of the hallmarks of hippies at that point was they didn't shower. And so they really didn't like it. They were tripping. They were on acid too.
Yeah.
So that must have made it very difficult.
Just at the time of our taping here, I will bring this up because he was an influence of George Harrison, Jimi Hendrix, Bruce Springsteen. Just got word that Duane Eddy passed away at 86 years old. So I wanted
86, to...
86 years old on a New York Times feed. Just wanted to throw that in because he was an influence to George. But the other thing I wanted to bring up is find Queenie Epstein, one of the most interesting people in the whole Beatles story.
Yes.
And it was great that you got to speak to her. And the professor and I became friends with Sid Bernstein over the years. And Sid used to send her the book section of the New York Times. And that's how he befriended her.
She's a big book reader.
Yeah. So tell us about Queenie Epstein.
When Peter Brown asked me to write the book with him, The thing that I reacted to greatly is I'm a gay Jewish boy from Brooklyn who grew up above his grandmother's clothing store.
Another one? Oh,
I know several. I'm so embarrassed.
I know several.
So, and Brian was a gay Jewish boy who was from one of the wealthiest families, but they had a retail store. And I understood Brian's shame. I understood Brian's torment. Because I went through many years of therapy trying to become straight. Many, many, many hard years. And I was fascinated that Brian might have killed himself because in the long run, he was going to be lonely. And this wasn't right for him. And so when I went to meet Queenie, I loved her already. She was the mother, the protective mother of a boy who was so unhappy. And he was going to be an interior designer. He was going to be an actor. He was going to have everything. No matter what it was, she was behind him. And when he came up with this ridiculous idea of managing a rock group, she was still behind him. And I look forward to it. And she was fragile. Even then, when I spoke to her, she seemed pretty fragile. She trusted Peter. And she said to Peter, there are certain things you're not going to talk about, right? And he said, yes, but he did. He did talk about it. And so I love Queenie. I asked her some personal questions about Brian, which she reared back on and didn't want to go there. I asked her if she thought it was suicide. And she said, no, she thought it was an accident. And I said, Peter Brown says it was an accident. And I said, Freud says there are no accidents.
I wanted to ask you about that, Stephen. Why that comment at that time? That one really stuck with me in the Queenie segment. I was fascinated by that, actually.
I in retrospect, I should have said it. However, I believe that he did try to commit suicide. Peter found him, stopped him. They took him to the hospital and pumped his stomach. And this is a slow buildup of drugs in his system that finally killed him. I believe he was headed down that road.
You're not wrong. I think that pulling from Freud it's almost poetical the way that line comes in. If I'm reading this as someone who has studied and taught literature forever, that line really ties that whole unit together. And it's not that Freud is right all the time. He's been deconstructed himself over the years, but boy, that one really held something because it was by degrees, as you're saying. It was really by degrees over time. And one wonders, not that Stonewall cured everything, but if Brian had held on somehow a bit longer, he might have been able to appreciate and be part of a whole dawn of a new era.
He had terrible choices of boyfriends. They all took him for money or beat him, or I mean, he just had, I don't know, he was very destructive. I have something to tell you that I never actually told before, but when The Love You Make came out and Peter and I traveled halfway around the world, one of the places that we went to was Liverpool. It was a big bookstore in downtown Liverpool, if you call it downtown. It was a huge bookstore. And Peter and I were sitting side by side at a table, and the line went out the door, I mean, for people to get this book signed. And a young girl came up from behind the line. She walked right to the front of the line, and she screamed at Peter, "You killed my grandmother," and then walked away. So I looked at Peter, and he said, "It must be Queenie's granddaughter." So I thought, well, that's odd. And then it took me years to find out that when The Love You Make came out, it made Queenie so sick that we discussed Brian and his homosexuality and his being blackmailed and all that she was hospitalized and that she never recovered and eventually died. And it's terrible. It's terrible. And I'll never forget.
True. You believe that's true, Stephen?
Yeah. I mean, I believe that. I believe she was shocked to know, because she said to Peter, "We're not going to tell everything." And he did. But yes, I think she read it. And I think Peter betrayed her. I think Peter betrayed Paul. I betrayed all of them. He did. And yes, I think it made her sick. I could see she was fragile already. When we spoke to her in 1980, the book came out 83 or 84. But this is the first time I've ever told that story.
Talk about something that sounds unintentionally very religious, that Peter betrayed Paul. Huh. I'm taking my Catholic upbringing, but at the same time, it certainly isn't a consolation if someone's grandchild claims that you're responsible for their grandmother's death. But what Brian helped bring to the world and the Beatles' message, if people are pulling that from their music of love, a love universal, it wasn't love universal for just you and you and you, but not you folks. It was for everybody.
That's true.
Right? I mean, it was for everybody. And, there's no better gift in the world. No?
He was an amazing soul and he did an amazing thing. He made some mistakes, but there wasn't a rock and roll business to look back on and say, oh, this is the kind of cut that we should get. This is what I should do with merchandising. I mean, people didn't know he made some bad decisions, but his passion for them, his passion for the group and what he had helped create helped because they were, it's so unusual, John and Paul, which amazing geniuses they were. And they were from Liverpool and they ran into each other one day. This whole story, it still gives me the chills. Look at their effect that they had on music, on the world, on politics, on culture, on the way we think about things. It's just really remarkable. And I can't think of another phenomenon, musical or otherwise. Well, I can of otherwise think of things that affected the world as deeply as they did. But they were remarkable. Without Brian Epstein, it wouldn't have happened that way. Brian made it happen. And when he died, it became unglued. It all became unglued. That was Paul tried to take the helm, and John wanted out anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing. And you know what that they all say in the book? Everybody says it was time. It's okay. It was time that it ended. It's fine. It ended when it should have. And that's what Freud says. There are no accidents.
Well, you do interview David Putman. Now, I'm not very familiar with him, but he shared some insights about Brian passing away. He said some things about Linda, not very nice things. And I think, if my memory serves me correct, he kind of says in a way that John could have saved the Beatles from Alan Klein. And you interviewed Alan Klein.
A rare interview with Alan Klein, yeah.
Yeah. And so how did you find Alan? And of course, Putman had his insights about Brian passing away. But yeah, John could have saved the Beatles from Alan Klein.
Well, first of all, I asked Alan Klein if there was a lot of screaming that went on. And he said, only Linda screamed. Linda was pretty tough. And then also Alistair Taylor, who was their loyal servant and butler and footman and did all these amazing things. They fired him in the end. And he said he was one of the last people that were fired. It was Neil Aspinall, Peter Brown, and Alistair. Everybody else from the Beatles contingent had been gone. And Alistair couldn't understand why he was fired. He asked Alan Klein, and this is in the book, does Paul know about this? And Alan Klein said, oh, I wasn't sure about what happened. But Alan Klein knew what happened. Paul was away with Linda somewhere, and Linda wanted the house redecorated or changed or something or painted. And so Alistair was left there to do it. And there, while Paul and Linda were away, the entire house was redone. And then when Paul came back, he had to go through all the bills. Linda went through the bills over her shoulder, and it seemed very expensive. Maybe it was. Maybe the Beatles were being overcharged. Maybe it was because it had to be done overnight. I don't know what. And she said to Paul, this guy is ripping us off. Fire him. And if you believe that story, it was Linda who insisted that Alistair Taylor be fired. Alistair wrote to Paul many, many times saying, Paul, just say hello. And I had such a good time. Why won't you speak to me now or pick up a phone or something? And he never ever heard back, so.
Yeah, and it wasn't Alistair. Certainly he went to the cavern with Brian. Am I correct, Professor? I don't know if either of you, but wasn't he offered like a percentage of the Beatles? And he said, no, that's okay. Don't worry about it.
I never heard that, David. Did you? hear about that?
No. Well, maybe unless he had any other role in NEMS, then yeah, that probably would have been part of it.
He was there at the cavern. But yeah, that's not a good way to treat Alistair. And that's certainly a glimpse into Linda.
And Alan Klein, just being in his presence made you want to shower. I mean, he was such a con man and a sleazy. And how John and Yoko could have fell for this. They claim that it was because he said that in the deal that he was going to make for them, that $1 million it would go to Yoko so she could make her movies, her avant-garde movies. And that what really convinced John and Yoko to go with Alan Klein was the fact that Yoko was going to get $1 million out of it. But it was a terrible, terrible, terrible move. And it's a shame in a way that Paul used Linda's brother as the attorney. By the way, he just passed away maybe 2 months ago or 3 months.
John Eastman did?
John Eastman, yeah.
Oh, I didn't remember that because I was invited to his home for a dinner with Paul.
And out here in East Hampton or
in Manhattan.
In Manhattan.
In the Upper East Side through Tony Bennett, who's been a friend of mine for 40 years. I got an invite to a really nice dinner with Paul.
Was that fun?
It was great. It was a lot of fun, a lot of celebrities there, but it was Paul not acting like he was out with fans. He was with his friends. So it was a different kind of feeling with Paul.
He's amazing like that. He's charming. He's kind. He's just terrific. I mean, he's a really nice guy. I don't know if he recognizes me, but you know, we live in the same community now. And people think the Hamptons is a great big place, but it is not. In East Hampton, there are only 22,000 year-round residents. That's not a big town. And so I see Paul a lot. And actually, I don't know if he recognizes me or not, but it's scary. When I see him, it really is. Scary.
Well, when I went to the Eastmans, I was told, hey, don't take any pictures. This is Paul with his friends. But I did steal. Well, didn't steal, but I took some napkins.
Great. What are those three candles? Or what is that on top where it says the Eastmans? Oh, it's Christmas.
Oh, I don't know what it is.
I think
it's three candles. Yes.
Yes. That's wonderful.
This is the only proof I have of being in John Eastman's apartment, which is really magnificent. Master paintings everywhere. I mean, gee. But I do recall now that, yeah, you're right. He did pass away. But, you know, we're going long. I don't want to keep you much longer, but we have to talk about Magic Alex. And I've interviewed Ringo a bunch of times, and I seem to recall we talked about Magic Alex. And he said, Chachi, he talked about speakers being in the wallpaper. And once he said, someday you'll talk to your phone and your phone will make the call for you. And I'm like, it wasn't all that far-fetched, but listen, I think Magic Alex wanted to be John's boyfriend. Certainly, he loved the control he had over John, right?
In a sexual way, he didn't want to be.
Right, exactly.
Or in a loving way, he didn't want to be John's boyfriend. But yes, he wanted to be John's sidekick and in control of everything. But he was just a liar. He lied about so many things. And John put his faith in just the wrong people. Alan Klein, Magic Alex. Magic Alex he never gave interviews. And he was, you know what, I was so fed up by the time. I think I interviewed Alex the night before I left London to come back to New York. And I think it was just over it by that point. And I don't think I really badgered Magic Alex into giving me the kind of interview. I just knew that he was a liar and a fraud. And sometimes you can't hold up a mirror to Don Quixote. So I asked him some questions and I got the feeling about him. He's dead. He's gone now too. So I don't know if we went through this story, but the last time I was there, do we talk about Cynthia Lennon and the ocean?
Yes.
Yes. But I won't reach
out. No. You should tell it here because that was on the radio show and it's a great story and people should know it. So please.
So when we were in England doing the interviews, Cynthia had opened up a bed and breakfast in Wales, I think it was. And Peter Brown and I went up there and we did an interview. And I thought Cynthia was melancholy, sweet, soft-spoken. I liked her very, very much, and I felt like I wanted to protect her. I liked her a great deal. And so, excuse me, before we left, I said, oh, she was doing drawings. Hold on for one sec. Can you?
Oh, see this? Oh, yes.
Let me do it this way.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. And it says along the bottom, I haven't taken very good care of this. It says, let's see. Stephen, thank you for opening a new door. One door for another or something. Well, anyway, what happened, the reason why that happened was when she showed us the drawings when we were up there in Wales talking to her. And I said to her, look, I live in East Hampton. It's a big artist and writers community, and I might be able to get you a show. Would you come to East Hampton and have a show at a gallery? And she was absolutely thrilled. So I came back here and I spoke to the man who owns a place called Tower Galleries out here. And I said, Cynthia Lennon. And he said, oh my God, yes, absolutely. John was gone at that point. And I think it was the summer after he was murdered. And he said, yes, sure, I would love that. So Cynthia came here with a girlfriend from Liverpool and stayed at my house, and which I loved. Because she was just a delight. She wasn't a delight the way Patty Boyd was, but she was just a pleasure to be with. She was very quiet. She was polite. She was really nice. She was thrilled she was having this show. Nothing sold. But anyway, they were kind of like what I showed you. I mean, so we spent a lot of time together. I recorded nothing when she was here because she was my house guest. And I didn't want to, although we talked about things. And then I think two nights before she was about to leave, we went out to have a celebratory dinner at a steakhouse. And Cynthia drank a lot of wine always. And we all drank a lot of wine that night. And then, boom, driving back to my house, Cynthia said, let's stop at the beach and go. I think she called it wading, which is where you roll up your pants, or she took her dress and tied it in a big knot at her side so it wouldn't get wet. And we went to the edge of the ocean. All of us were holding hands. Oh, I was with a colleague of mine, Joseph Olshan, who's now a book publisher. And we all held hands and walked to the edge of the ocean. And it was really dark. And then a wave came out of nowhere and knocked us all over like we were bowling pins. Boy, did that. That was really scary. And I mean, of course, we were like pulled out when the wave went out and it was nighttime. There was nobody else on the beach. And Joe Olshan managed to stand up. I managed to stand up. Cynthia's girlfriend managed to stand up. And then where's Cynthia? And then we see she's maybe 20 feet away and the back of her skirt is billowing up. She's face down in the water. Well, she had a lot to drink too. But anyway, Joseph Olshan unfortunately swam for exercise every day. He was a swimmer, and he swam out there because I couldn't go into that ocean. And he swam out there and he pulled her back out of the water. And then we got to the shore and there was we were shivering. We were all wet and everything. We got back in my car. And then for reason that, I mean, I guess it was so emotional that we started to laugh. Not normal laughter. I mean, shrieks, crazy, laughing and laughing. So much I couldn't start the car and drive away. We just had to laugh and laugh. We were shivering too. So we drove back to my house. And as we're driving back, Cynthia says, a nice hot fire and a cup of tea. I'd like to sit in front of the fireplace. And I said, great. And then I'm thinking, I have no firewood. Oh my God, I have no firewood. And then in England, you'd be arrested if you didn't have firewood. So we got back to the house and she went to dry off. I said to Joe Olshan, I have all these newspapers. Roll them up really tightly into like long sticks. Roll them up. And we rolled up about 20 of them and I put them in the fireplace. I built a little teepee of them in the fireplace. And Cynthia came down and I said, Cynthia, I'm sorry, but we only have these newspapers, but it'll be good. And I lit it. And maybe it burned for 4 minutes. With all those newspapers, it burned up. And I said, I'm so sorry. And she said, that's the story of my life, a paper fire. I'll never forget her saying that. The story of my life, a paper fire. And I kind of understood what she meant. This big explosion of Cynthia Lennon, the Beatles' wife, and then bam, slapped to the side. A very, very bad divorce thing. Didn't have much to do with his son. There was Yoko Ono in the picture. Magic Alex went to trap her about having. So I understood completely. And I really loved her. She's really great. I'm sorry she's gone.
Yeah, I got to interview and meet her when she put out the book with Coleman. And she came to the radio station. Very sweet, strong woman. Very, very nice. Very gracious.
Lovely, right? Just absolutely lovely.
Yeah, just amazing.
Joe Olshan saved her life. And
that's great.
He's my editor now on my new book. So,
well, Professor, we're running out of time, so get your last question together. I want to just ask Stephen about one more thing.
Well, Stephen, it's a wonderful story, but I'm also thinking, come on, man, bust up an old chair that you had lying around. Throw it in the fireplace. You might have gotten an interview out of her.
It was a rental.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, it was a summer rental. So
there you go. Summer rental. Title really of your next book, Summer Rental.
Funny. Yeah. So funny.
So, Professor, before we go to your last question, I'll just bring up that I love the fact that you spoke to Maureen. And we talked about George earlier, how spiritual he was. But there was another side to George. He had the power of the flesh, the desires. And certainly for years, we went not realizing that George kind of had a fling with Maureen. So your
thoughts on
that?
I don't know if it was consummated. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he did say that thing.
He was in love.
Yeah, I'm in love with you and stuff like that. I mean, it didn't go over well with any of them, with Rio, with Maureen or anybody. I mean, it went over very badly. But it's so odd to me. First, I didn't believe it. And then when I got confirmation that from both Maureen and Patty that it actually had happened, I was really surprised that George said something like that. How could he say that to Ringo's wife?
Yeah. You know,
what was going on in his head? Maybe he was tripping and she was one of the knots that his karma had to untie him.
Well, that was, I think, Chachi, was it maybe Phil Norman who said, well, that was almost like the interior, don't break the Beatle code of going after another Beatle's wife.
Yeah. Like that, right? I see that. By the way, I love Shout. I love Shout. Yeah, that inspired me.
That inspired me as well. That's when I read that I was just in high school, about to get out of high school to go to college. And when I read that, I thought, I always fancied myself getting into education. I said, this makes me think, along with the documentary on television, The Complete Beatles, those two together coming out around the same time. I thought, this is an area of academic study. This can be taught. That's where I first really got the idea about that, and then realized it was a whole connected to a whole world of the fandom and conferences and such. So yeah, no, I that's kind of point one for me when it comes to all of this. Really, the first book in the library.
I totally agree with you. It's a story about culture, about society, about music, about friendship. It's a big story. You're absolutely right, and worthy of study. And I mean, they affected everything we hear today. Yep. In some way or another, they affected everything that we hear.
Yep. Well, Stephen, a pleasure to speak to you. It's an honor. I've been a fan of yours for years. Professor, we need to have Stephen back just to talk about The Beach Boys. That book, I have it in my bookshelf over here. What a compelling book.
Well, I have those transcripts.
That and the sort of forced march just because of what he eventually, a book coming out about it, but you know, learning to play golf to support your profession as a journalist. I love that. I'd like to hear stories about that sometime as well.
They paid for the lessons.
Oh, hey, there you go.
You've never seen anything until some grumpy golfers are behind us and I can't hit the ball. And Alice is saying to me, let them play through. Let them play through. Because I was an idiot with the golf club. But I loved Alice.
Well, I did too, and I've met him many times. We, at the former radio station I was at, we did a big golf tournament, and we invited Alice to come to Boston and play in the tournament, and he did. It's just that he has played in some of the most fantastic golf courses all over the world, and this one we brought him to was so bad, but he had a good time. He was a very nice man.
We played in the Bronx, and we played in Brazil, and we played in Scotland, and sly thing it was of me to try to figure out how to play golf and to get taken around the world. And heck, driving Alice's Rolls Royce, that wasn't too hard. I don't care if he sat in the back. That's, you know, But thank you so much, both of you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to just free flow like this and talk about it. Much appreciated.
Well, we very much appreciate it. The book is called All You Need Is Love, The Beatles in Their Own Words on St. Martin's Press. You can find it wherever fine books are sold, on Amazon. Is there any site or website you want to mention, Stephen, to get the book, or is that good?
No, if you have a good review, write it on Amazon.
Very good.
We're only down to like 4 stars or something like that. Why didn't they interview John?
Yeah. The book is fantastic.
Thank you.
Interesting, every chapter. And it's great for the professor and myself. I use it as a reference guide on the radio show, and you use it with your students, right, Professor?
Yeah, any oral history like this is fantastic. We'll put it up there with Please Kill Me, The Oral History of Punk. This is a great oral history as well.
Yeah. Thank you again, everyone.
Mr. Stephen Gaines, thank you from the bottom of our heart. We love you.
Pleasure.
Be well. Give our love to Mr. Brown next time you talk to
him. I will, sir. Yes.
Please do. We love Peter Brown, the consummate Englishman.
He was. He is.
And so thank you for listening. It's Get Back to the Beatles. You can hear this podcast. We have many back episodes you can listen to, the Boston Podcast Network, and wherever you hear your favorite podcast. We're speaking with Stephen Gaines. All You Need Is Love, The Beatles in Their Own Words. Mr. Beatles Professor David Gallant, we'll talk soon.
Yep.
And until next time, be well, love one another, and we'll talk soon.
Get back, JoJo.
Make sure to check for the latest episode of Get Back to the Beatles with Chachi Lapret at pod617.com, the Boston Podcast Network.